Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Library of Virginia. I'm Mary Flynn. I'm a senior editor of Blackbird, an online journal of literature and the arts, which is in part responsible for this gathering, along with the Library of Virginia. We're welcoming to town Betty Adcock, Deborah Greger, William Logan, Deborah Nystrom, Dave Smith, and Ellen Bryant Voigt to read from the poems of Claudia Emerson. And David Wojahn will introduce the evening.
It's an honor to be introducing the six poets who will be reading tonight from Claudia Emerson's work. You can read their bios on the handout that's been provided. They'll be reading, as Mary says, in alphabetical order. And they are among the finest poets at work in America today. Collectively, they've published over 60 books and won scores of fellowships, awards, and other distinctions. They have come to Richmond from all over the country, and they represent a very broad aesthetic spectrum. What unites them is a love for Claudia Emerson and the deepest regard for Claudia's poetry. Among them are some of Claudia's closest friends and fellow poets, her colleagues at the Suwannee Writers' Conference, an event that meant a great deal to Claudia, her longtime editor, Dave Smith, and finally, the poets she revered as her mentors, Betty Adcock and Ellen Bryant Voigt. They all know very well what a remarkable individual Claudia was. Know her as an immensely dedicated teacher who was deeply devoted to her students. Know her as someone completely down to earth and wickedly funny who had absolutely no tolerance for pretense and bullshit, but who was also as insightful and intellectually rigorous as they come. And they know her as a poet. And among her generation of poets, there wasn't anyone better. She achieved that status in part because her poems made difficult reckonings and come to hard-won epiphanies, and never more so than in the writing in her new collection, Impossible Bottle, which we're celebrating tonight. And she also achieved that status because her poems are so impeccably crafted and so unobtrusively daring in their formal invention. Auden famously said that more poets fail from a lack of character than from a lack of talent, and God, Claudia was possessed by a surplus of both. That's an incredibly rare thing among poets. And to say she is missed by us all, and to say that her work lives on, true enough though that may be, is just plain insufficient. But you will hear what suffices tonight in Claudia's poems, and I think she would be delighted to know we are gathered here tonight to celebrate her work. I want to thank our readers, thank the library, thank the indispensable Mary Flynn, and especially thank Kent Ippolito, Claudia's husband, who more than anyone helped the poems you will hear tonight come into existence. I'm very proud to introduce our first reader, Betty Adcock.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here. I'm honored to be here, to be part of this. I will have to hold the pages close. My eyesight is kind of going, sort of going. Anyway, I have to blow things up to see them, and I have to get them close to me to read them. Wouldn't Claudia love this, though? She would love to be with all of us here, many of us who didn't know each other before, but who were close to her. Her time at VCU, I think, was some of her happiest, maybe her happiest teaching time, even through the illness. She loved it here. I met Claudia when she brought me to read at Washington and Lee, where she had her first teaching job. She was just out of graduate school and was still polishing her first collection. I was old enough to be her mother, but we were two women from the rural South who were passionate about poems. So we became fast friends. We visited between North Carolina and Virginia many times. We were writing and we shared our poems. We shared poems by other poets that we loved. We read poems on the phone. It was a wonderful time. I knew from the beginning that she would be a marvelous poet. She often visited us in Raleigh, bringing sheafs of poems and quirky gifts. All over my house are reminders of her love of the piquant and strange, the richly old, and they were wonderful, wonderfully personal gifts, like the antique brass fox door knocker that she brought after I had written a poem about a fox I saw the night my husband died. There's a little brass hand that clutches an Emily Dickinson line. There is a book about feathers. There is a wire bee. All of these things, there's a strange ring, all sorts of interesting little things that she would find. And they were all personally chosen because of something she knew about me. I think she was an observant friend to many people. We've all heard her say, "I'm not the smartest one, but I'm the most curious." And she was that. She was the most curious, and she was often the smartest as well. But she loved the things of this world: plants, animals, birds, objects, people, and gave herself with absolute abandon to that love, out of which she wove poems of narrative portraiture and lyric grace, of place and person, of serious mystery, praise, and yes, despair. I learned from her discipline, her devotion to formal properties, and her edge, her dark wit, and her playfulness. If she said I was her mentor, she was no less a late one for me. We shared many things. I think she knew that she would not live a long life. I think there was a premonition somehow even early on, but she outshone it with her incredible courage and energy, her faith and zest for life, and the love of the wonderful Kent. In Impossible Bottle, Claudia confronts her illness, the hope, the wish, and also the anxiety and despair. She confronts this in the way she confronted all of life, in poems. She did this without whining, self-absorption, or self-pity, but with a steely understanding. It can be hard to read. It is very brave. There was neither denial nor emotional blackmail here. I'll read three poems. The first is from her second book, Pinyon, which was published in 2002 by LSU and has a special place in my heart because I remember what good times we had drinking wine and spreading all the pages of that manuscript out on my living room floor to figure out exactly how it might be organized. We worked together on the organization of that. Poem is called Glove, and these poems were monologues and lyric narratives spoken by a brother and sister who lived their whole lives on the home place where they were born, and the dates are given. The dates on the poems are part of the epigraph here. Glove. This is spoken by the sister. The brother and sister lived together their whole lives. This is spoken by the sister. Glove. Late August 1928, cloudy. All afternoon, as I snapped beans, as my lap filled with the sound of a man's knuckles cracking, she flew about me. I liked to imagine it was the same wren come year after year to the back porch, who chose to nest here amidst the mess the boys created. She found in it a wealth of hollows. One time she chose a swinging gourd, one year a boot. And though the boys fussed, I would not allow them to disturb her. Last year, she finally decided on a can of rusty nails that had fallen over, and she built on the frozen spill. She never chose well, and this was even more precarious. On the narrow shelf behind me, a lone work glove, molded open like the bronzed cast of a hand, cupped the emptiness she claimed. Once, in the dark of the root cellar, I shuffled heavy jars of beets, peach halves, snaps, tomatoes. Nothing looked good in that light. The jars I had yet to fill lined the bottom shelf, and a shadow in one drew me down. What drew a mouse into that empty black mouth? Once there, how long did it peddle against smooth, invisible walls in full sight of all it had left behind and all it could not re-enter? The skeleton reminded me of a ship in a bottle, sails furled, its ribs a fragile hull, the skull a socketed prow, bound to take on nothing as it cut a static sea. 2. At first, the wren stole close by, from the abandoned web of a spider, from the broom. Then she left me for lichen, moss, a long coarse hair from the mule. She worked ecstatic. In her mouth, she carried the earth, though she would lay her eggs where the palm's dry ache had been. We worked on. Beyond us, a hawk fell like a blade in the field where the cow rubbed her world broad forehead against the knot on a cedar. That shadow, the dead persimmon tree cast on the chimney, darkened until it was again a scar, or no, the wound itself, or any fissured reverie into which I could fall. And when night closed it, the seam would take me with it. Sometimes I felt as though I put up food for a great flood, that I filled the hull and waited for a certain rain. Or perhaps that flood had long come and frozen, invisible, the world beyond, sunken, the ghost town with it. And now I waited, icebound, for the day when the bird would not return, when she would instead disinherit the habit of this place. The next two short poems I'll read are from the Metastasis series that appears scattered really through the longer first section of The Impossible Bottle. And this is a beautiful book. The first one is Metastasis Worry Moth. Yours is not the majestic gypsy, the codling, luna, wax, or grander atlas, with the appetite of a plague, entire fields succumbing to them, whole generations of bees. This is the unseen, closeted, unassuming gray that seeks out last winter's cloth, another season, drawn to the body's scent. What was its heat? To consume early that scant much of you. Fragile, lace-like, the constellate erasures of the coat it makes for you to wear. And the last poem I'll read is actually the first poem in the book. It is called Metastasis, Intercession. There is a take on the burning bush here. It opens impossible bottle. Metastasis, intercession. Too late, here, perhaps, for some intercession. The physician speaks to his screen instead. To the all of you it has become. His words not imagined now, but real, and your sorrow is ecstatic, something you do not feel. You hear your own voice at a distance, in the abelia bush, outside, at home, a voiceless god, flames there, late bees, a burn, slow, miraculous such green. There you are.
I'm Deborah Greger, and it's a, well, I mean, how do we describe being here? I met Claudia when she invited William Logan and myself to Mary Washington. William to give his wild talk on Whitman. It involved hooting and hollering. You should be so lucky to hear it sometime. And myself to give a reading and to visit her class. This must have been in 2006, between the publication of Late Wife and the Pulitzer. It was the joint poetry workshop that proved the highlight. It was like sliding into a sister act that I didn't know I was part of. We saw her last at the Sewanee Writers Conference in 2014, though we didn't know it would be her last. She was bald, puffy, metastasized, and facing brain surgery in the fall, and still her warm self. She wanted to teach. I don't know if I can finish this. I'm sorry. Ecology. This poem is a masterpiece of the extended metaphor, and it breaks the rules that we teach our students. It begins with not one, but two abstractions. We tell them, don't title a poem with an abstraction that's going to give away the theme. She does that. It's brilliant. Then the first word of the poem is a second abstraction, not a repetition of the first. Ecology, the title. Bitterness, the first word. Bitterness here is not a curdling or a preserve. It is, after so many years, an ecology, something she cultivates like the moss that grows between the stones in the garden, not trusting its proven love of shade. She pours buttermilk on it, the acidity she knows to be pleasing. How dare this remind her of the great aunt who raised her, of the mink she stole, she wore to church, precious thing, cage raised, bred for the neck. She recalls the small chain that bound it, the way it seemed to hold its rear feet in its teeth, the mirror shine of its eyes, the way it saw her and only her. The three poems I'm reading are from the new book. One of my childhood memories is from going with my what was considered a medium-sized Catholic family, we only had seven, to Catholic Mass. We didn't have seven when we went then. There were only four of us. And in front of us was a lady wearing one of these stoles, and the two youngest, two brothers, started whispering as to whether the stole was dog or wolf. I mean, what could my mother say? And I think she was just kind of amused by these things. I don't remember if the lady turned around and bestowed one of those withering glances. That was the 50s. My mother didn't have furs, and she was the kind of mother who, when you brought her feathers, would stick them in her hair and then forget it was there and go off and do her grocery shopping. So here I am, a poet, because I had that kind of mother. Fast. Her daughters were born fast, three in a row. The older two, the ordinary disappointment most girls are to their fathers. The third one, God's child, she said, declaring it so. Birds, stupid, he called it, slow as a log chain through mud. The house she would never leave was on the steepest street in town, and the older girls learned there to be fast on skates and sleds, and then they were old enough for the married men, so easy and fast and grateful. No cleaning, no fights, just cars and the steep slant of a summer night, and the quick lie that an hour can be, the slickest one after babysitting his children, the road where they parked, the one with all the switchbacks, deer dead in the ditches, and they took to it like breaking into a house just for the fun of it, like stealing someone else's air, someone else's darkness, the stuff even the smartest woman will not miss. They were her only wildness, and she would lie awake for the hint of its return, some man's smoke fast in its hair, God's child dead asleep. The steepest streets. Some of you may know Claudia grew up in a town that was over a uranium mine, and that made her wonder about the source of the cancer. The last poem I'll read has a title that was a revelation to me. The title is Chain, Chain, Chain. Most of you will know what that title comes from. The Great Aretha sang it. I heard it when that song first came out. In the 60s, I thought she was singing Change, Change, Change. It wasn't until I saw this poem with the title in print that I realized I had heard it slightly wrong. A problem of the time I heard it in, and perhaps that I took my piano lessons from nuns. Chain, chain, chain. 30 years to the day since the virgin time. A nephew was the ring bearer, the rings tied down with slick ribbons to the small satin pillow on which he bore them. Pretending to pray, I watched ants crawl across his shined shoes. The pastor who declared it is long dead from cancer, my brother as well. That morning he came stoned, his hair long, aviator sunglasses blinding mirrors. And the brother-in-law and the in-laws, my own father, all dead. The friend who would later put a pillow over her face and shoot herself through it, knew what I wanted and sent it wrapped in butcher paper a Mexican wedding dress, white on white embroidery, stitches dense, intricate, the seamstress's signature, a single black strand of her hair sewed into the yoke. It was indeed perfect. It is. The April air, chill as it has ever been. I dance to chain, chain, chain before I take it off again and feed it to the fire I have set for this. There was a garden, a watchful gardener, a small cement pool, fat carp, a statue of a little girl carved into her dress of stone, her face abstracted by moss. Thank you.
I'm rather wondering, Miss Greger, what you made of that lyric as change of fools. What interesting interpretation you must have had. I'm William Logan. It's a sad pleasure, the saddest of sad pleasures, to be reading Claudia's darkly moving poems here tonight. I met Claudia a year before Deborah and I were at Mary Washington. I came down for a poetry reading, and Claudia was delegated, poor soul, to be my minder the afternoon before the reading. So she took me to some local coffee shop of a deceptively inexpensive kind with distressed wooden tables, immediately suspicious. You know you're not going to get the hand-rolled black tea from the nether slopes of the Himalayas. You're going to get some kind of sweeping from Tetley, but it's going to cost you four times as much anyway. She was wonderful, and we got along well. As many of you probably have experienced, in one's late adulthood, you rarely meet someone your age or a little younger who is a completely sympathetic character, the sort of person you thought you must have known as a child somehow, and now you're catching up again after a long time. And then to find that her husband is just as interesting. Well, couples don't often meet couples where there's a sort of combination of affections, at least not in my experience. Perhaps my experience is rare. It's nevertheless a privilege to read these poems tonight. I know that Claudia would have something rueful to say about this occasion, perhaps something on the order of what was said in The Big Chill: isn't it terrible that on the day they give you the greatest party ever, you can't come? She was a remarkable person, so unprepossessing in person, and yet so firm, controlled, dedicated, and ambitious in her work. And I think that in this most recent book has come to an extraordinary fruition. We continued our friendship through various stays at Sewanee, and through her various changes in focus and attention, and her move here, which I immediately understood. Having walked around Richmond for 5 minutes, I understood exactly why she moved here. I mean, I would move here myself. What did I see? Clay Street, these houses that seem antebellum, these beautiful clapboard houses 2 blocks off Broad. And somewhere north of Broad Street, a remarkable building that instead of turrets has giant milk bottles. I don't know what that is, but do not tear it down. It is an important building, I am convinced. And then a place called the Gourmet Hot Dog. Who wouldn't move to a town that had a gourmet hot dog with, I think I'm remembering right, a Pup Monday or a Monday Pup Dog, something like that. What's not to like? I'm going to read 3 poems. The first is Pasture Accident, which starts in an impossible way. And I guess I have to explain it. The first line is, fog that morning, all of them waited. Which might mean, I mean, it's a complicated and upended sentence. It might mean there was fog that morning that all of them waited. Or it could mean, in a more straightforward fashion, all of them waited fog that morning, which would be the straightforward syntax, but not very interesting. So the first line, I think, is a wonderful attempt to give more torsion to these words, and it's brilliant. Fog that morning, all of them waited. They were used to her voice, her hand on their spines, their flanks, her fingers in their manes, their tails, the pressure she brought to bear on the bits they let her slip into their mouths. Iron the instant then, when she bent to fasten a buckle on a blanket. The physics a wrecking balls, the hoof's wall and soul that knew best this pasture's perimeter now sank that same kind of deep into her cheekbone, brow, her nose, forehead, jaw, the orbit of her eye crushed, and with it that side of the world. She came too near blind, the blood already cool and clotting. Through it, she heard grass moving, the arrhythmia of grazing, a bored sigh. The fog had lifted to rain. She could make out a crow drinking from a pocked hoofprint in the mud, as though from something breakable, what remained of a horse, of a pasture. Then, last, the night. Sickness kept her house the way winter kept the garden, a betrothal. What had been forgotten at its outset remained so. What little it did recall, uneasy, vague, the birdbath surface opaque as milk glass, the pansies in bright collapse, the mail collected like leaves, wind gathered in corners, books she had abandoned face down, everyone somewhere near a beginning. But the sundial remained fluent in light, in time, and afternoon slowly returned to her, tempting the window open wide as though for milder air, her elbow on the sill, a cusp, where she learned to trick birds into mistaking her cupped hand for the feeder she had hung next to it, her arm like the thin column of a candle, and she had perfected its going away with night, the way it did not tremble beneath the flame. I called Claudia this afternoon. By mistake, I meant to call Kent, and Claudia's cell phone number is one digit away. And she answered. The voicemail is still there, so I invite you to call Claudia and tell her what you think. I hung up. I was too cowardly. But it was so lovely to hear that voice. When I expected to hear Kent's voice, it was Claudia instead. I was very moved. Last, the scar. I end with this one because I think that it contains a lot of what Claudia was and what Claudia is. The scar. The fainting she cannot recall, or the strike of her face against the table's edge, only the waking, the blood in her eye from the brow bone, her mother's face so close to hers, she could not see her. The remedy? To fill the gash with soot from the stove, a quick staunching. The firebox still hot with live coals. The bleeding would stop, and the wound heal over to this, palest blue, reminiscent of an eyelash tattooed, prettied as though meant, something she might have chosen for herself. She does not have to tell it for me to see a morning's shimmering heat, the room of that child's house, her mother seeing her the way she sees me, through this indelible sill of ash, and behind it, the fire that had given the stove eye its brightest ever aura. Thank you.
I'm Deborah Nystrom, and I'm very glad and honored to be here celebrating Claudia Emerson and her work. It was such luck to get to know her over the last 10 years and to be able to share poems back and forth with such a passionate, brilliant, honest reader. I wanted to just say a couple of things about this book, Impossible Bottle, that we're here to celebrate. It's breathtaking in the way it sustains Claudia's characteristically concentrated yet receptive observation. Even as the subject observed becomes self in the process of losing self. In all of Claudia's work, one follows her exacting attention to the concrete as well as to the metaphorical, not quite noticing at first, yet not questioning it when you do, that the literal and figurative worlds sometimes change places in her poems. Figure becomes ground, and ground becomes figure, Metaphor and object of metaphor shimmer and displace one another, not because the poem is in any way vague or ambiguous. It's the very precision of vision and language that allow us to fully recognize the profound effects of paradox. The clarity of Claudia's work is what allows a deeper exploration of the mysterious. So I'm going to read four poems from Impossible Bottle. The first is MRI. At rest, the machine makes a softer sound, almost pleasant, something like a lone cricket, perfected in its measure. But the technician is too bright, illuminant as the room, talking with someone in the glassed control booth about Dixie donuts, and so overweight I cannot imagine she could fit herself into the tube where she will send me in minutes. It is Friday, late afternoon. There can't be many of us left to see. She feeds me into the mouth of the thing, telling me to follow the breathing directions as best I can, and I do, for the next 3/4 of an hour, breathe in and out and pray, curse, clench my teeth, sorry as I have ever been for myself, and suddenly sorrier to realize that I am the last of the many this day. Someone else's face was just this close to the low ceiling. Someone else's worry saw this flat whiteness. In my hand, I hold the small, bulbous call button everyone must hold. With the same nervous lightness, I can imagine holding a moth, so as not to kill it and not to let it go. The metaphor for it metastasizes too. I am in the belly of the beast, the belly of a whale, in some sterile wilderness, desert island, sand blind. I am a thread in the deep eye of a needle, in some percussive other world that rises up every time I exhale and hold still my empty lungs. And then I come to and settle on a tunnel, a real one, the one they call the pawpaw for the nearby trees, and a day in early June 3 years ago, and I can stay in there long enough to survive it again, artifact of a place, 1/4 mile through a mountain in western Maryland. You are never out of sight, the end of it, and still you find you do need that borrowed flashlight you thought you could do without, its battery feeble, jittery beam. Mules and men died in here, hauling out the stone to make this passage, narrow towpath alongside a stream of water you can hear but cannot see. The way out is searing and round, a worthless sun that lights nothing but itself, and still you choose it, the entrance behind you just as fixed but changed somehow, another state, no, another country, farther away now, you are sure, than this. This is the book's title poem, Impossible Bottle, which we heard the echo of in one of the poems Betty read, an earlier poem, Impossible Bottle. I recall it as a lens, thick, dimensioned, its neck the stoppered threshold to a chamber, the chamber an encapsulation of the ship, a clipper, graceful and lean, its sails pristine, the delicate thread of its rigging. That kind of green glass my mother had seen only on weather vanes or as decorative part of a lightning rod, the glass's survival, sculpted proof of a strike that had not yet happened. When I was small, we drove only one time to the ocean, all of us afraid of that kind of water, that horizon. The day we left for home, she told me to fill a bottle with air, to steal some away as a souvenir to open and breathe one winter night when my attic bedroom window would seal me in and threaten to let me forget that day, its perilous air. And she recalls exactly how the ship got in there, suspended, bottled against wind and water, driftless in the dead sea of the cupboard where she'd keep it. She was young then and had never seen the ocean. She was already wearing a ring on a chain around her neck to hide it from her mother. The ghost ship's arrival was at the hands of a man at the fair who took her money to let her watch him slip the slim, collapsed body into the bottle and then, with a single practiced tug of thread, raise it to the hereafter of her house that is sealed now, as she says it must be for the very old. She rarely opens a window, even on the mildest day, impossible as it has ever been to worry too much about the wind. And this is the fifth section of Infusion Suite. I am not this, not here, this time. I am what I mistook for a shadow in our walled garden, gathered beneath the concrete bench, concrete also the sky, like the cold, sorrowful bottom of something. It is a collared shadow, though, a stray cat I see us feeding in the afternoon. And I will watch it eat from a dish on the back stoop, then bathe in the open doorway of the garage, in that narrow shaft of afternoon light where I will be also, and also behind it, where I am the body of light that swings from the rafters. And this last one I'll read is the anatomy lesson resection. You didn't know what to do with the wisdom teeth, so you saved them for a while for nothing, or what to think of the ganglion cyst, smooth, benign, they removed from the wrist just above the pulse. And then there was the first biopsy of the cervix, a plug the size of a pencil eraser, they said, and that mole you'd had all your life, they all of a sudden called suspicious. And the nuisance the gallbladder became, and the thyroid gland. But it is the tumor in the gut that gets everyone's attention, its slow, mute explosion in the liver. This time, you are the anatomy lesson, your surgery a sharper degree of difficulty. Starched, bleached, their names newly stitched on crisp lapels, the medical students file in and listen. They write things down. They observe the operation. There is a quiz, a test. You are the exam. What they can access of you, theater, now in the surround. You are the text, the close reading and radical revision, the offensive part lifted out and taken away in a pan, fetus-like, brain-like, that kind of measure, that kind of heft. Only they can tell you, when you return to them, what you can live without, what regenerates, and on hearing it, you feel a lightening, the way a snake must on slipping through its discarded mouth into another year, or knowing nothing of a year, into time itself.
I'm Dave Smith. I want to thank Mary for inviting me to come today. The last time I came was to celebrate Larry Levis, and now to celebrate another dear friend. I'm not answering the phone next time, Mary. I don't know when I first met Claudia. I can say, though, it must have been about 20 years ago. In the early 90s, I was asked by Les Philibom, then the director of the LSU Press, to choose two books of poetry a year in a series that I would edit. The first book I chose was Terry Hummer. The second book was Claudia. So, at least by 1996, I must have known her. She permitted me to publish six of her books. None of them were ever outshined by any of the others in a very, to my mind, terrific series. When I try to think of what Claudia was to me, many things come to mind, but two words particularly, tender and tenacious. I liked the fact that she could be so gentle, but also tough. I took those six books without too much argument from her. But there was always some. She was always right, of course. The thing I admire today is she was as much a craftsperson as you will ever encounter. She wanted to know what was right and how to get it right, and worked very hard at that. But the other thing I liked very much about her was the fun she could have. And the fun she brought others. I'm not very good on the telephone. Claudia would call and talk endlessly, endlessly. And yet, now I think of those hours of phone calls as fun, and I miss them. She liked to write about a lot of things. I got to read the poems probably as early as anybody, maybe first. So I thought I'd read a couple of poems that were about birds. She seemed to like birds. They always allowed her to say things she wanted to say. This is a poem called The Practice Cage from Late Wife, a book published in 2005. I was taking my routine run, the same 3 miles just past daybreak on the jogging trail that encircled the playing fields, the home of the Fighting Eagles. I'd run that course so many times I imagined myself a goat circling the invisible stake of the baseball diamond's off-season desolation, scoreboard blank before the lightning sky. Behind the stands, I heard first the dozen crows that crowded around a practice batting cage, a metal-framed room-sized rectangle, its sides and ceiling made of a thick, heavy net. Then I saw the cause of the complaint, a red-tailed hawk on the ground inside. I'd spent most of my life in the country before moving to this city. I'd seen hundreds of hawks, but what I knew of them was distant patience, or an extreme diving speed, or death. I walked toward the cage, and the crows rose, scattered. The hawk flew up into the corner, struggled there, twisting upside down as though tearing this other sky with his talons, before going limp, still turned, wings splayed outward. Where I expected tension, fury, I saw instead the taming of despair. His eyes resigned to this, to me, softened somehow, as though with forgiveness. I could see where he'd flown in, one edge of the netting gapped, so I worked the nets to raise the hem higher, while the bird hung, indifferent to my effort, so motionless I was certain he was injured by the struggle. But when I spoke, urged him, tugged at the net below, he seamlessly let go from that stillness, dropped down, and righted himself into flight, finding at once the wider gap, and was, with no wing beat at all, gone, clearing the lip of the stadium to disappear into the turning stand of poplars bordering the fields. I began my run again then, elated by the sound of my own breathing, by my feet striking the ground beneath me, by knowing I would round that same turn time after time to see again in that familiar emptiness something we had revised, an absence finished. A similar poem, not the same, but similar in its way, in her next to last book, called Common House Sparrows at JFK's International Terminal. They survive in factories, warehouses, even coal mines. Some were, after all, shipborne. And so that they are here should not surprise. Their small host, a constant nervousness, accepted, ignored, around and about the food court's balcony, just above security. From their perch, a skeletal sculpture of abstracted aluminum and guy wire, they seek breadcrumbs, grains of rice, of salt and sugar strewn beneath tables and chairs, their survival dependent on redundant carelessness. Perhaps they are not captive here and meant to enter through an air vent or skylight. Or perhaps they succumb to curiosity and the happenstance of the automatic door's slow revolve to become the only natives of this place, everyone else transient, destinations ticketed, mirage-like. They bask in what light manages to fall through soot-fogged windows, or bathe in the slough of never-ending passage, arrivals and departures in perfected synchrony, thus windless, rainless, asylum enough. I like very much what I think, if I remember correctly, is the last poem from Impossible Bottle, another bird poem in a way, but one that ought to bring before us all Kent, the man who gave her the kind of joy she gave so many of us. This poem is called Kiwi. Those of you who have had to polish shoes will recognize that bird. Her husband kept a small wooden kit filled with buffing rags and brushes, flat cans of polish, with an image of something like a bird on the lids. Saturday evening meant taking it out of the hall closet to polish their good shoes for church, and that was where she got the notion to do it. Fashion a canvas from a bedsheet or one of his work shirts nearly worn through. There she would paint a translation of what she saw reflected in the kitchen window, her face, the glass she had to look through, and what she could see of the world she saw through it, indivisible from the back pasture, her cheekbones, broom sedge, her hair, the tree line, a widow's peak. All of it she cast again and again in what she had to, blacks and tans, parade gloss dew, ox blood lips. And when she snapped the lid back on, she could not help but consider the why of the shy silhouette of that bird, the two notes of its song unheard of here. Nothing left it but the vestiges of wings, flightless, foreign, and the familiar art of sorrow.
I'm Ellen Bryant Voigt, and I share a hometown with Claudia, a little town called Chatham, which is in Southside, Virginia. And I never moved quite wholly into town. It's the county seat of Pennsylvania County, which is the largest county in the state, and drew to itself professionals and two private schools, one for girls and one for boys. And her family did. But her family, like mine, came from large farm families around in the county. I'm enough older than Claudia, so I didn't really know her growing up, knew her parents, and I knew her older brother, who was roughly, inexactly the age of my brother, and who was also a student in my mother's first grade class. And that was before she graduated herself and went on to the fourth grade, and where she was then Claudia's teacher in the fourth grade. And I, by that time, had left the area and had gone away and was no longer playing the flute. And Claudia really wanted to be in the band, and so my mother let her play my flute. So this is our profound connection, is that she played my flute. But we came from some of the same country people. So the first poem that I want to read to you is from The Impossible Bottle, about those country people and sort of what that context was in general. And this is a poem called My Mother Senses Them. Her mother preferred the Ouija for calling up the dead, cajoling, cooing, the talking board set up on the kitchen table, small portal in the planchette. The letters had traveled forming words, a slow slur. She says she hears, no, senses them more easily than that, the dead untranslated, my brother closer than he was in life, closer than when she bore him and his blue misery into this house. And his is a nearness that does not frighten or forebode. His arrival, an owl's,
coming up from the night-felled trees, so silent it is its own shadow, or an astral body, and she does not know whether it is the walls or distance itself thinning or the world to allow it. Another bird poem. Hmm? Another bird poem. Where I came across Claudia as a grown-up person, as a young woman, was when I received a letter from her quite out of the blue, who introduced herself as someone who lived in Chatham and had come back there after school and had married a local boy. And in fact, I knew his parents. They went to our church, and so I knew his parents pretty well. And so there she was back in that small town. You've already heard mentioned up here about her use of figure. And you've also heard a little bit of how those figures tend to cluster, whether it's that wedding dress and the figure of the girl carved in stone, or the bird that's in the cage. And it seems to me, when I think back about that letter that she sent me totally out of the blue, that said, I understand from Mrs. Hurt that you write poems, and I'm trying to write poems, and I'm sending you some, and I just want to know whether I should keep doing this or not. And certainly after many years of teaching, maybe I recognize that, you know, here's some talent here. But mainly, I think what I recognized was that they were compelled. They were absolutely compelled. So I wrote her back, and I said, yes, I think this is a very worthwhile thing for you to do, and you should continue to do it. And there began a sort of off-and-on correspondence as I went back to Chatham to visit and see my parents and eventually my sister who moved back there. Then we would tend to try to see one another. And I think that those elements still continued, especially as she stayed there and the possibilities for her there were extremely limited. So going off to teach, you've already heard reference to that. First going off to school, going to Greensboro, then going off to teach, then going other places to teach, and then taking a job there. And I think, especially on the opinions, Betty, that you talked about putting that book together, she was immensely concerned about writing poems in the voices of others. And yet that, I think, was an extraordinary move and helped to prompt what happened in all the remaining books. Because it was another version of that, of finding the figure, finding the other person who could speak, and also finding a location for her empathy and her observation of the world, to then be able to say she and to go to these other figures in this other kind of circumstance, which for her, from what I saw, was always worse than her own circumstance, was always more dreadful than whatever it was. And what it was for her, very often coming out of these country people that we grew up with and derived from, was a huge sense of duty. So I wanted to read this other poem from Chatham for you, because at the time that she sent me these poems, she had a job. She was working for the post office, and she was delivering mail. She was a rural letter carrier, as was my father as well. She had a slightly different route from his, but her route actually took her by Tosh's and took her by a number of places. People here from Chatham, and so they know where Tosh's is. So took her by a lot of the places where my family members had grown up, and hers as well. So this is rural letter carrier. For a brief while, the 86 miles gave some illusion of travel, the season's slow cycling part of it, the sky moving from cloud to clearing, fields turned under or crowded with corn, crows, soybeans, tobacco, snow. But the road did not change, finally. Not the straight stretches nor rain-fretted curves, the relentless echo of gravel ping, the hushing of dust, mud hiss, and skunk musk. The houses went down over time, the men dying away, then the widows. In the yards of emptied houses, Their children went on living in trailers with tires on the roofs. And the names on the mailboxes and the ones in the ragged graveyards were the same. Some people hung their clothes from barbed wire fences to dry. And as long as I had been driving that route delivering her check, one old woman still hid behind the trunk of a sycamore in her yard until I drove off again. Some days, I stopped at the country store where a few bottles of soda floated like blasted fish in the drink box, where men checked deer and turkeys and bought bait, where no one knew any news but of who died. It only took my Sunday absence for a wren or sparrow to begin a nest in the mailbox forgotten open, or a hornet to finish one that I'd find hanging down like a gray wattle or a venomous gorder from the throat. They said there wouldn't be letters anymore, what with people getting news through the air and money just numbers on a screen that added up to a worse nothing stored in a machine somewhere, all of it invisible, unflying, reckless, swarmless as thoughts never meant to be spoken, then spoken. I had driven through enough lonely days to believe sometimes I passed by those hours instead, like estranged houses to which I might return some distant day, not to deliver a day's worries and ordinary temptations, but the letter addressed in a hand so far away, so familiar, it would need no other understanding, having found in me its last and only way. I want to read just one more poem and just say one more thing. Because of the Chatham connection, I wanted to pick some poems that I recognize as being prompted very much from that particular place. But poems, of course, are not journalism, and poems are also not historical documents. She was not writing history. What's amazing about the poems and the life of that work is the trajectory away from the prompt into something that is larger and more universal, that has come about by becoming more interior. And that's where I think her great twin gifts for figuration and for empathy then were brought to bear. And they were brought to bear through hard work and determination. But this final book is quite remarkable. And it's not just because of the biographical circumstance in it, although one will find that immensely moving, but because even in that occasion, she was able to find insights that make poems that are memorable. And this is the last one I'll read. It's called Well. Well. When I first knew it, it was already a structure of sheer sentiment, more remnant than place, covering the old neglected depth it took to get to water. My mother's uncle, whose voice I can't recall ever hearing, built it, the tall wall he knew to sink there because of sycamores, ghostly water seekers, seemingly out of place, and a well eye he must have noticed brimming with ferns. The same water in the house would later be made plain by comparison, tepid, tamed by spigot and pipe, basin and drain, our chapped hands always in it, under it. It is not so hard now to understand what was for a long time unrecognizable, a given, that source as absence of something, a backing out of this, pipe, house, us, all of this, so perfect as to be invisible.
Thank you to Claudia for her wonderful poems. Thank you to our readers, to the Library of Virginia for providing this venue, And please go buy the books. Thank you for coming.